Hey everybody, this is Bobby Osinski and welcome to my inner circle. This is a show all about music, music production, and the music business, and today my guest is going to be Brad Lundy, who's the founder of the Trans Audio Group, which is a distributor of high-end audio products like ATC, Drummer, TubeTech, Bach Audio, Daking, A-Designs, and a few others that I'm leaving out. But first, let's talk about the changing music business, and we all know it's changing from downloads to streaming, and it's changing quickly. But there's also an interesting thing that's happening right before our eyes, and I hope that you're watching, because it's a consolidation that's beginning to happen. Up until this time, there was a lot of different streaming music competitors out there worldwide, and there still is, but now we're starting to see them picked off one by one. It started a few years ago when Apple bought Lala, and then, of course, Apple bought Beats Music earlier this year. And now there's word that we have Google that's looking to buy Songza. Now, Songza is relatively small, and this is a small deal. They only have 5 million users. But what it's showing is that slowly but surely, all of these smaller players are going to be gobbled up by the big ones. Now, in the end, what I predict is going to happen, we're only going to have a few players left. And it's sort of the same as the record and CD business that we had, where you had a lot of smaller independent labels, and sooner or later, if they had any sort of traction, they were gobbled up by the majors. And we're starting to see that again in streaming music. And what we're going to see, I predict, is within a few years, we're going to be down to three major players and maybe one or two other music distributors, and that's it. So we'll probably have the big three, which is going to be Apple, Amazon, and Google, and maybe Spotify. I think Spotify is probably a really good candidate to stick around unless they're bought by somebody. And maybe one more. It probably won't be Pandora. Pandora is having a bit of a problem because there's more money going out than there is coming in, first of all. Because of their licensing agreements, they can't really spread to other countries. It's basically here in the United States. So as a result, they're not a great candidate. Oh, the other thing, too, is, of course, they have 77 million users, and that's a lot. But it's not growing at the rate that it was before. It's kind of plateaued. So they're not an ideal candidate to be bought unless they have a fire sale, which I doubt is going to happen. Probably what you're going to find is in the end, there's going to be the big three, which is Google, Amazon, and Apple, and one more. And again, I'm predicting it might be Spotify because they have the most traction, but it could be someone else as well. And Spotify could be bought. Now, I understand that right now there's a lot of pressure on Spotify to sell. The record labels, if you didn't know, major record labels own part of Spotify. That was the only way that Spotify could actually get the licenses from the major labels in the United States that they needed. And that was to sign a deal with the major record labels. So they were part owners. And now there's a lot of pressure on them to sell because they see how much money was made with Beats. Who could buy them? Well, obviously, it has to be one of the big players, or it could be a telecom. It could be AT&T, for instance. It could be Verizon. If one of those wants to get into the music business really quickly, that would be a way for them to do it. And, of course, the interesting thing is they have their mobile platform, which is always a good way to get some traction. And, of course, Beats Music just tried that with AT&T, and that probably allowed them to get as many subscribers as they managed to get. But here's why I think we're going to be limited to only the major players. First of all, if you look at Google, and if you look at Amazon, and if you look at Apple, they don't need music. Music isn't all that important to them. Music could go away tomorrow, and their primary businesses will still stand. Whereas if you look at Spotify, Pandora, RDO, and just pick any of your favorite streaming music distributors, you'll find that that's all they do. And they don't have the pockets, of course, that the big three have. So I think what's going to happen is within a few years, we're going to consolidate and we're going to be down to just a handful of players, kind of the way it is in the music business, where, remember, we used to have six major labels, and now we're down to three. So these things keep on happening. That's just kind of the way it goes. So just watch out for that, because it's happening right before our very eyes. The other thing I want to talk about is a plugin that I found. And I rarely talk about plugins or endorse them or endorse gear in general, but this plugin is really helpful. It's one of those things that, oh, why didn't I think of that? It's called Magic AB, and it's by Sample Magic. And you can go and you can get it at samplemagic.com. And here's what it does. It allows you to easily A-B your mix. It goes across your mix bus, and literally it says A and B. A would be your mix bus, and B would be one of 9 songs that you can call up. And the reason why that's cool is, imagine the number of times that you wanted to compare your mix to a song, either one of your mixes that you've done or something that you really like. And it's a drag, because what you have to do is you have to load it in to your computer and you have to solo it. It becomes another track that you have. This makes it so much easier, because all you do is you just insert it on the mix bus, you call it up, and there's a bunch of presets. So you can preset songs for a particular genre if you want. The reason why this is important, and let's say you're just starting to mix, the way that everybody learns eventually, and of course, there's basics that you have to learn, and you can read any number of books, and of course, I've written a couple books, Mixing Engineer's Handbook and the Audio Mixing Bootcamp, and you can get all that information, but eventually it comes down to listening. Eventually it comes down to your own ears. And the best way to figure out how you're doing is to constantly compare what you're doing to the real world. And you're either comparing it against mixes you really like, or mixes that you've done before that you really like that came out really good. And the faster you can do that, the more you can keep something in memory and go very quickly between one and the other, the faster you can kind of figure out where you are in the grand scheme of things. So Magic AB is very cool with that. The other thing it does, it allows you to just adjust levels on your songs. So for instance, you may have some that are mastered and they're louder than the mix you're working on. Well, you can actually go in and you can lower the level to where it's identical. So you can really hear what the mix is like in terms of compression, in terms of EQ. You can really zero in on things. And you can do that for all 9 songs that are queued up. The other thing you can also do is, if you want, you can just loop certain sections. And let's face it, sometimes there is a certain section of a song. We don't always want to go back to the intro, which might be quiet, or the bridge, which might be the loudest. Maybe it's something in the middle that we really need. So Magic AB is something that will allow you to do that. The other thing that's kind of cool is, if you're an experienced mixer, you've been doing this for a while, this kind of allows you to check some gear out really easily, and especially speakers, I'm thinking. So you get a new pair of speakers in, and you want to kind of figure this out really quickly. What sounds good, what doesn't? And this is a very easy way to flip between songs that you know, so you can evaluate things, again, much easier than you would normally, rather than having to pull a CD out, put another one in, or calling up a file, or whatever. This just makes it so much easier. Magic AB is something that I highly recommend. You can get it from samplemagic.com. It's not expensive. It's $58.50. You can also pay in pounds and or euros. Also, it will take lots of different file formats, just about everything, except for AAC. So if you want to play something off of iTunes, it doesn't do that yet, which is kind of a drag, but it does everything else. And this may be one of those times where you might want to go onto a site like HD Tracks and download a high-res version of something you really like, of a Steely Dan track, or Donald Fagen, or you know, whoever else you like. Download one of those at 9624 and use that as your reference. So this is one of those times where that's a pretty cool thing to do. So check that out, Magic AB from samplemagic.com. If you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. My guest today is Brad Lundy, and he's the founder of Trans Audio Group, which is a distributor of very high-end audio gear. He's also one of the smartest guys in the pro audio business, and he has some great, great lines. ATC loudspeakers, which are so highly acclaimed. Drummer, of course, which everybody knows. Tube Tech, which everybody knows. Bach Audio. Bach Audio makes some great microphones, boutique microphones. Daking, audio, and of course, Daking makes really good Trident style boutique modules. So there's a lot of cool things that Brad distributes, and he's going to tell us exactly how he does that, how he get into the business, and really what a distributor does. I spoke with Brad via Skype at his showroom studio in Las Vegas. Well, hello, Brad, and welcome to my inner circle.
Hi, Bobby. How are you?
It's good to have you, and everybody who's in the business knows you very well, but the people that aren't directly in the pro audio business aren't, they may not be sure of exactly what you do. So describe what it is that you do.
Okay. Well, what I do is I'm a person that tries to help inventors make their product real in the sense of finding a market, finding people to help them, finding dealers, finding end users. So my goal is to try to help somebody, I think, who's a, you know, there's people that make gear that are artists just like the people that make music. And my objective is to find those guys that are honest, are doing it not because they want to get rich, who are doing it because they really believe in it, and trying to help those people find a market for their products. And it's quite difficult because many of those inventors don't really know how the business works. They're not really good at sales or not good at dealing with dealers or advertising or PR, any of the things that you might have to deal with as a business. They just want to make microphones or speakers or, you know, electronics. They don't want to deal with all the rest of that business stuff. So I help them. I'm essentially their front end. I let them make stuff and then I help them find a way to sell it so that they can continue making things.
And that's why when someone goes to a NAMM show or an AES show and they come to your booth, they see all sorts of different products there. Because I know there's some casual observers, there's some musicians, some engineers who don't really know the business. They come and they look around and they say, well, who is this guy and why are all these manufacturers in this one booth here? But that's why.
That's why. And You can't really get rich at this, but I always tell my kids the number one secret to being happy in your life is finding something you really are happy doing, and you find what you're really passionate about and try to figure out a way to make that your living. Well, I was always interested in music. I was always interested in sound and was interested in gear from a young age, and so I found a way to make that a living. Again, you don't get rich at it, but you know it's really satisfying to help somebody find a mic that makes a better vocal or get a pair of speakers that helps them work faster or find a compressor that actually solves a problem of too much level in the studio so they can make that vocal sit on top of the mix the way they want it to. It's kind of fun to be able to do that.
Now, you have a big background, though, prior to this, prior to going out on your own and representing manufacturers, because you were at JBL and EV, and you know, you had a corporate background, so you're basically well prepared for this, much more so than most people that try this, right?
Well, I don't know if I would say I'm more prepared than others, because I don't know that you can really anticipate all the things that happen, but I would put it this way. I feel like I've been fortunate enough to have experience as a dealer, experience as an end user, experience in as a large manufacturer. When I worked for JBL, I was at a very high level in JBL, and I really enjoyed that. But the corporate life is a different kind of life. It's a different way of living. And then I worked for a very small manufacturer, privately held, and traveled all over the world, and I loved that. It was really great to go to places like Bangkok and see people using gear and on their television show or television audio in Bangkok. It was crazy to be able to see that and all over the world. So it was interesting to try to look at things from all these different points of view. So now I kind of don't feel like I'm really all that smart. I just feel like I've made most of the mistakes and I try really hard not to repeat them.
Yeah, but so many people in the business come to you for advice, which, I mean, that says something. That says you pretty much know what you're doing, or else that wouldn't happen.
Well, like I say, I think I've probably tripped enough to know not to go that way anymore. You know, you need to try it this way.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's a business that it's fun to do if, as long as you can do it in a real high integrity way. I think the difficulty in the business is that the money sometimes can distract you and get you off your course. And if you think about the money too much, I think that's when you sort of get off in the wrong direction. When you think about serving the customer and trying to help people do a better job and improve their work, I think then you can stay really focused on the right things.
But that's what you've always done, though. I mean, you've gone out of your way to set up demos for people, to have people experience the products that you have, and that's rare. That doesn't happen that often.
Yeah, well, I think if you're going to sell somebody something that is seems awfully expensive to them, you have to help them see the value in it, and help. The only way to do that, it's just like a guitar. The only way you really get it is to play it.
Yeah.
And it's, and with a pair of monitors, the only way you understand that you can hear through the mix and hear every little detail in a way that will help you solve problems faster, you have to actually experience that. You can't just look at that on a piece of paper, because the truth is, we don't really have a way to write down on a piece of paper all the criteria that goes into what makes one product different than another. It's just really hard to document that. The human ear is still the best determinant factor in whether something's better than something else.
And what you're referring to are ATC monitors, which are the high end of the high end, I would say. But anybody that's ever heard of them and experienced them can understand why you'd pay, you know, the big bucks for something like that.
Yeah, I mean, ATC is a really good example of a company that's owned by a group of people who are really passionate about building better tools. And they don't really see themselves in the business of trying to build a company that makes more money. They see themselves in the business of building equipment that helps people. So given that, they've never stopped trying to figure out how to innovate and to make it even better. So it so happens that the owner of that company is a great transducer designer, which is very rare. There's not many people like that. But it's the way JBL started. It's the way most big speaker company started, but ATC is small enough still that they can pay attention to the details. And their main business is studio monitors, and then they also build sort of the same product in a hi-fi form. So they do some high-end hi-fi as well. So
did ATC start getting traction mostly in the film side of things?
I think they really gained some ground in film early on, because it really helped people understand really dense mixes. Because they're very low distortion speakers, the denser the mix, somehow the greater the value of the speaker, it feels to me. When you really want to drill down and pay attention to the tiny details, ATCs pay off really big. If you're just trying to balance, and that's really all you're concerned about, you know, NS10Ms work really great for that. And there's a lot of really talented mix engineers seemingly can mix on anything. And I've witnessed that happen, and it's a humbling experience to watch a skilled mixer be able to seemingly mix on any old speaker. But for a lot of us, it's really hard to mix on something that does not translate well. It's really hard to anticipate how the sound you're hearing will relate to the real world. You really need something that tells you the truth about it, and ATC seems to have figured that out, where if you just mix to the way it sounds on the speaker, you're good. You don't have to try it in the car. You don't have to try it on NS10Ms. You don't have to run around trying to make sure it's going to translate. It just does.
Yeah, I know. The one mix that I did with them, I was so impressed. They were out of my price range, unfortunately, but boy, they were great, I got to say. I understand completely why you'd want them to mix on all the time.
Yeah, it seems like ATC is a company that, and it's like that with a lot of the things that we sell, we end up doing business with a lot of the most experienced users in the marketplace who seem to instantly understand what the product means. And then it sort of trickles down from there, where the people that are working for those people, who also have a lot of independent projects, learned it through working with someone who owns them. And then as they go out and they set up their own thing, or as they get better and get their own clients, they want that same sort of platform to work from, and then expands from there. And I think a lot of people that have not experienced what really high, it's kind of like a studio. If you've never worked in a really high-end studio that has a quiet noise floor, you can't explain what that's like to someone who's working in their bedroom. And it isn't to say that working in the bedroom's wrong. It's just to say that there is value in some of these environments that people spent years and years and years to put together. You have to experience them to understand them, I think.
Yeah, it's a reference point. I mean, it's the same thing with mixing. Until you know what a really good mix sounds like, or really good sounds, well-recorded sounds, you have no reference point. Then it's hard to know what something bad is because you don't know what something good is.
Yeah, it's really difficult, I think, for young people, especially when you're trying to figure out how to make a good mix. I pay attention to the forums and read what people are writing, and they're often asking for advice. What's a really good monitor? What's a really good this? What's a really good microphone? And they're very swayed by marketing and advertising because they don't trust their ears yet. And they don't feel like they know, they really understand how it all works. So I think it really helps when people can get some form of reference, whether it's to go to a school that can teach them that, or whether they can go into a studio environment in a major facility and sort of experience that. I think, it's interesting when I think about the business, how much it relied on apprenticeship in the past and how people used to work for. Just with Ed Cherney over the weekend, and he talked about how much he learned working for Bruce Swedien.
Yeah, of course.
And he was a second engineer for Bruce Swedien, and that was a very important phase of his career of acquiring that knowledge that he didn't have before.
Yeah, that so rarely happens now because there's so few studios as compared to the way there used to be. And it's really a shame. I mean, that's one of the reasons why I write books. It's trying to capture some of that knowledge, some of that industrial knowledge before it kind of goes away, and at least give someone a chance to get, what you can from a book. It's not the same as working with somebody, but at least to hear the stories, I think, it's helpful.
Well, and getting correct information is a really crucial to people's understanding of all this stuff. Just understanding how a compressor works, for example. I've talked to you for years and years, and you're always very good at explaining complex problems in an understandable way. And I think it's really key for people to understand the mechanics of the business that they're in. And audio is an area that has a lot of complicated things going on, and that can take a lifetime to understand. So it's really important that you never stop learning. I think what you're doing here is interesting because you're constantly trying to put more information out there to help people better understand what's going on.
Well, it's called attention deficit disorder.
Yeah, I know. I think a few of us have that problem, Bobby.
I would say, yeah, right. I think that's a prerequisite to being in the business in a way.
Yeah, easily bored. You need new things all the time.
Yeah. I have a philosophical question for you. So,
sure.
Well, actually, let's start here instead. This is better. What do you see as the state of music retail right now?
I think it's in transition. I think the difficulty of music retail is that the business has shrunk in many ways, and the customers are not sure exactly how to get the information. There's enough information out there that one could feel that you don't need to talk to anybody anymore, that you can gather the information on your own. But in reality, it still feels to me that there's a value to actually experiencing direct contact from a person that has knowledge and can help talk you through something. There's something that's special that happens when two people talk to each other, an understanding that you can't get off a typed interaction or an email. Just the way a voice or the inflection of someone talking changes your perception of what they mean. And so I think the personal one-on-one interaction that a retail thing offers is the thing that's the most difficult to replace. And so it's interesting to see how many of the independent dealers that used to exist around the country are gone. I remember when I started my business in 97 or so, there was a major pro audio retailer in just about every major city in the U.S., and they're all gone. And they've gone away a lot of times because larger companies came in and took over that business. They're gone partly because the studio business has gotten smaller. They're gone partly because there's the emergence of mail order that happened in the 80s that became a very big thing through the 90s. I think there's a whole lot of reasons, but I think the thing that's happening is that we're seeing people recognize information as valuable with experience, meaning the more experience you have, the more you value information from people who know what's going on. And I think as you start out, you don't understand the experience so much, so you don't feel like you need someone to tell you what the right thing is to do for you. And so those people quite often are prone to just walk in and buy whatever the hot thing is today, or the cool brand, or the thing they've been marketed the most. And it's interesting, I see a lot of marketing for brands that I never, as being really hot studio products, that I've never seen in a studio in my entire life.
Yeah.
And, and of course, all that stuff gets sold to people under the premise that it's appropriate for what they're doing. And many people don't know that it's very difficult to be professional using that gear, so they sit and think that it's them. Well, sometimes it's the product. So I personally would love to see a return to, you know, the independent consultative type business that was so popular way back then. But if I look at other businesses that are out there, they all seem to be mirroring the same thing. You know, you look at the hardware business, it's a very much the same. You used to be able to walk in with a bolt into the hardware store and say, hey, I need this, and he would hand you that bolt. Now you have to go to a store and buy 40 of them, because you can't even see in the bag whether it's the one you need or not. So the business, I think all businesses change. And I think that's part of the problem with music, is that music retailing is it's undergoing the same evolution that all businesses are undergoing. I'm encouraged, because just like what we're doing now, the ability to talk to people online, the information that's available online, is so much greater than it used to be, that there is a lot of ways to gain information without necessarily having to walk into a local shop. But I do think that personal touch from an experienced person, it's sad that that's missing now. It's sad that that doesn't seem to be available down the street anymore.
I was looking at your dealer list, or at least the dealer list for some of the lines that you carry earlier, and I was actually surprised, because I didn't recognize some of the dealers. And not only that, they seem to be in places that I would have least have expected.
Yeah. Well, and I think that is because I've tried to specialize in trying to understand what dealers do and how they bring value and whether or not they're honest and straightforward and really doing the right thing. That's really important to me. And so I've sort of hand-selected people around that I believe in and that I think will echo the ideas of the manufacturer and my company, and try to do the right thing for the customer. And so some of these companies have arisen in places that do seem odd, but they're the right people. And so I don't really put too many restrictions on their location. I'm really more interested in the people behind them. You know, so it's up for me, it's all about building the right relationships with the guy that owns the business, just as it is with the manufacturing. I want to know the guy that builds it. I want to know the guy that sells it. And if I can put those two people together in the right way, where the guy that sells it really gets the idea behind the guy that builds it, then I think you have the right match.
So you don't have too many problems with a dealer territory, for instance.
Well, it's frustrating in that you wish you could tell somebody, hey, you're in such and such a town, this is the guy to see. But in many towns across the United States, there is no one.
Yeah.
There is no dealer. You know, I it's frustrating sometimes to figure out what to tell people. And if you tell them, you'd rather tell them somebody who really knows the situation and is not in their town than someone who's in their town and doesn't really understand the product. So I think for me, it's finding the best people that will talk to the right customer as opposed to finding somebody that's nearby. Because I think people now are, you know, I know it's just my own experience when I'm out trying to buy something simple like a refrigerator. I don't know anything about refrigerators. I want to go find somebody that actually knows something. And that's just a bit of a challenge. You walk in a lot of places locally and you'll talk to 9 out of 10 people just seem to want to point at a price range and say, well, that one's better than that one because it's more.
Yeah, right.
You know, and I don't, that's not what I'm interested in. Just the same in the audio business, you want someone that says, well, that one's $100 more because it has this switch to cut out the lows that you're going to really need when you record in your bedroom because your bedroom is going to have low-end problems. That's the guy I'm looking for. So I'd rather, when customers call our company and are looking for where can I go to buy, you know, a Bock microphone, I can say, hey, call this guy. He knows a lot about them, and I can be confident that he's going to get taken care of.
Speaking of Bock microphones, David has been one of your clients for a really long time, I guess since he started, right?
Yeah, yeah. Well, since at Sound Deluxe, he hired me early on when he was at Sound Deluxe, and then I stuck with him all the way through that, and then when that closed, and then helped him relaunch his Bock Audio, and been with him, I don't know, we've been working together now since, I guess it's been pretty close to 13, 14 years, something like that.
One of the things that really made me understand how special David was, we got to talking one day and he told me that he actually learned German so he'd go back and read the old manuals from Neumann microphones. I thought, wow, that's really dedication.
Yeah, yeah. Well, this is exactly what I was talking about earlier. I'm interested in somebody that's so passionate about the product that they're not really thinking about the money. And that's David. Yeah. And most of the guys I work with are very, very similar to that. And, you know, that's John from Tube Tech. That's Marek from BetterMaker. They're all very similar people where they're just so focused on the product and trying to figure out how to bring an idea that they have forward. You know, David, I always thought was very unique in the business. I've known a lot of people that make microphones, and a lot of them are really nice guys and do really good work. But the thing that makes David different was that he's one of the few people I ever met that could engineer to a sound, meaning that if he knew what this microphone sounded like, he could figure out how to get there from creating it himself. And that is a very unique skill because most people know how to either build something really great or build something that just sounds the way it sounds, and then they figure out how it works in the studio. They kind of go backwards. This is the way the mic sounds. Figure out how to use it. David does it the other way around. He figures out what you want to use it for and then designs a mic that works for that application. That's a very unique approach to microphone building. And so he studied a lot of the old microphones, which he himself, having been a studio tech for a lot of big studios and been in the business for years himself, and stood there in the studio when a big time producer would walk into him and say, this U47 sounds different than this U47. I need them as a stereo pair. I need to use them tomorrow. Make them work. And then turn around and walk away. And he had to figure out how to do that. And I think that's kind of how he learned his chops. So he's very unique in that business. So when he builds a mic that we call a 251, it captures that vibe. It's very elusive to capture. And a lot of people don't know how to get there. And I wouldn't know how to do it. And I've known a lot of people that are really good at building mics, but they don't know how to build that specific sound. So I think that's why I like working with him, is because he does something no one else does.
Yeah, it's more than just the components. You can't just put the components together, the old vintage components, so to speak, and expect everything to work the same way. It doesn't work that way. As we've seen with all sorts of different audio and musical gear, I mean, it happens over and over where, you know, you think that it should work and it doesn't, or at least you're sold on the fact that, well, it's just like the old thing, but it doesn't sound as you'd expect.
Yeah, well, and also the context changes in a mix. For example, you can demo a microphone for a fellow, and a guy will be naturally, or a girl will be naturally attracted to a mic that has more high-end and low-end. And then you put it in a mix, and that's exactly the opposite of what works in a mix. Now it becomes impossible to use this device in a real mix because there's no mid-range, and that's where the vocal is. So what good does a microphone that has great low-end and high-end do to record a singer when there's not the correct mid-range. Well, you need to be in the studio. You need to have mixed. You need to understand that to actually be able to build a microphone that has the right mid-range and the right relationships to high-end and low-end in the mid-range so that when it's used in a mix, it appears correctly. And that's the beauty of these guys from the 30s and 40s that built these microphones. I mean, it's amazing how they're still popular today, but they were really small artist craftsmen kinds of inventors. And they worked one-on-one with people to develop things. And I'm sure that Neumann in 19, when it began, looked very similar to the way Bach looks today. You know, and I'm sure that many of the manufacturers that we work with now were very similar to the early Fairchild and the early manufacturers of this gear. They were just working to please an end user. They weren't necessarily working to make a bunch of money. So when you get in that situation, having the experience of knowing what works is the whole ballgame.
When the recession hit, I know that because you deal with a lot of high-end clients, they didn't seem to feel it as much. They were still buying gear. And now that we're past the recession and budgets seem to have gone up a little bit and there seems to be more money around, do you find, I'm sure they're still buying gear, but do you find that the level below that is buying again?
You know, I think the business is better for most everybody in the business right now, but I wouldn't say that it's gone from awful to fantastic. I would say that it is, you know, a little better for them because the people that buy an $8,000 pair of monitors, you know, those are people that are working and they're not people that are hobbyists really, even though hobby people might, you know, like me personally, I'm still not buying expensive luxury items in my own personal life. And I don't think people in the studio business ever looked at the products they buy from us as luxuries. So I think they see them more as tools. So I would say that really what's helping us the most and the other people in the business that do high-end audio is that there's just more music going on and there's more projects. I mean, for a while there, the film business really got slim and there was almost no scoring being done. It was all being done on a keyboard. And electronic music was the score for everything. But now they're hiring orchestras again and things are happening, even though they're trying to find ways to save money and they're going to Toronto and they're going to England and they're finding ways to cut the budget. They are doing things again. I mean, you know, there's some movies have been successful, like, let's say, Hunger Games and things like that, that have generated significant demand for orchestral music. So it's good to see that the demand for music is growing again. And I think that that helps sort of floats all boats, if you will.
I know you've been a critic of the AES in the past, at least of the conference, that in fact it was too big city centric, so to speak. And of course, the music business exists mostly in the big cities, especially LA and in New York and London. But you've always advocated actually taking that on the road and taking it to the smaller cities.
Yeah. Well, I really, it's difficult when, you know, AES, when it grew and it became a really big thing, the business was so vibrant in so many different categories. And when you went to an AES show, there were people there representing live sound, there were people there representing recording, people doing broadcasts, people doing tape duplication. There were all these different segments of the business that were very vibrant and alive. And audio engineering represented all the best knowledge in audio across a broad spectrum. Now we have shows that represent some of those segments. You know, we have NAMM doing really well in music. We have, you know, shows like Infocom that have absorbed NSCA, which used to be more the live sound and distributed sound. And we have various different shows that have specialized in narrower and narrower categories of the business. And some of those manufacturers that used to go to AES have abandoned AES and gone to their specialized show. And of course, AES survives based on the exhibitors that come to the show. And the difficulty, I think, for AES is trying to figure out how to please everyone. Where the problem is that you have a changing customer base for AES, meaning the exhibitors are changing and becoming different. And my point to AES is that if recording is the number one thing you're doing, as it looks like it has been for the last number of years, then you need to focus all of your energy on recording, and you need to focus on the end user instead of trying to focus on a model of that was actually designed for dealers, where the show was a way for manufacturers to talk to their dealer base. Well, as you started out, you're talking about dealers and how there used to be hundreds and hundreds of dealers, and now there's, you know, 20, 30, 40. Well, they actually don't need to go to AES show to learn what's going on, because the manufacturers have websites and they are talking to them all the time. But what we do need is for end users to be aware of the products that these manufacturers are making. And the end users now are, to me, feel like the focus of outbound effort. So a trade show is a perfect venue for reaching out to end users and saying, hey, this is what's new, this is what's going on, and here you can finally talk to the guy that invented it. He's standing right here in the booth. Come walk up to David Bach, or, you know, Ben Lilly from ATC, or John from Tube Tech, or Peter Montesi from A-Designs. You can talk right to him and ask him, hey, what is? Tell me about this piece of gear. You can talk to the expert. I think that is a really important process that needs to be brought out to a larger group of people that are all over the country. So I really wish that there was a way to bring the AES style convention, if you will, to a much smaller group of people in a cost-efficient manner, so end users could get access to that information. Because that's what I think everybody wants, to kind of look behind the curtain and see what's going on. They want to look inside the studio. Hey, how are they doing that? What? How does this work? What does a Daikin compressor really sound like? And trade shows offer a really good opportunity for that. I'm really, really happy that AES is coming back to LA for the first time in, it's been, 10 years or something like that?
Yeah, a long time.
And I mean, that's the center of the recording industry. That's where most of the recording happens, there in Nashville. And the AES chapter in Nashville has become more active in the last number of years in presenting a smaller conference and presenting exhibitors. I participate in that as well, and trying to reach out to get those end users to interact with the not only the makers of the gear, but the gear itself. So it's exciting to see that happen. I do wish that there was a way where AES could go do road shows and very small scale shows that were inexpensive to put forth. But, you know, again, it's very difficult for companies like, you know, even large companies to figure out how to operate on a small basis. It's hard for AES that's makes their living off of exhibitors coming into a central location where they can put on a conference where kind of all the people that work for the exhibitors are in one central place. That's their revenue stream. So how do they take that out to Wichita, Kansas, and make that work for kids that are playing in bands there and want to know about how to record? Very tough thing to do.
But now we see manufacturers doing that with their user conferences. I know I was just at the, last year at the Personasphere, for instance, which I was surprised how cool that was, actually. And what you had was a dedicated core of people who came from all over. They came from all over the world, really, to participate in it. And we're seeing more and more of that happening. Of course, DigiDesign had that before NAB, and we're seeing more of those things happening. I think that's maybe the future.
Yeah, and I just came back from GearFest, which is Sweetwater just put on. They had 10,000 people there.
No
they
kidding.
They had a whole bunch of manufacturers. We were there with almost all the gear that we have available, and all the other high-end people were there, as well as a lot of guitar people were there. You know, it was a big deal, and Ed Cherney was there, and Ross Hogarth was there, putting on educational conferences. So I think you're right. Presonus, and there's a lot of other manufacturers. I know Harman's done some outreach stuff and trying to do this. It is difficult to do it as a manufacturer, because you're very tied to trying to figure out how to have this make money for the company and not just be a loss. But I do think it's a sign that people want to reach out there. In the old days, we had reps that traveled the whole country and they would talk to people. Now the manufacturer can hire a product demonstrator, put some stuff in a van, and pretty inexpensively, and drive around and make that happen. Now, like for me, I don't have enough revenue to support that kind of work yet. But a large company like Sennheiser or Harman or PreSonus, they can do that. And I think ultimately maybe we'll see some of those manufacturers band together and form some kind of a group and maybe be able to do that together where they could all draw together. Because, you know, at AES I do I do an aisle where I try to put together all the high-end manufacturers in one aisle, because I sort of it's the idea that if you get all the people that are interested in high-end in one spot on the show floor, walking up and down this aisle, everybody does better. You know, you don't need to worry about capturing a group for yourself. You just need to get everybody that's interested here, and then everybody has a better shot at letting people know what they're doing.
Well, you talked about the Audio Underground for a bit, which was an idea of traveling roadshow, right?
I still so want to do that, and I still own the trademark, and I still keep it alive and hope someday we can get Audio Underground Roadshow going. But I really do believe in the idea that someday there could be a mobile conference that could travel around as sort of a small-scale AES that would have a very high educational component to it. I think that's the key.
I think that's possible as well. But, you know, again, it's you have to make sure that you get enough people there to make it worth your while. So there's the marketing part of it. So unless you have the marketing part pretty much knocked, that's the most difficult part. And it's difficult for everybody to get that, really.
Very difficult. And I've talked to AES in New York about it. And, gee, is there a way you could ever go out there and, you know, just do a small conference in smaller towns where you have chapters? But, you know, it's sometimes even difficult for AES to get an active chapter going in these smaller towns. Like, it's interesting here, I live in Las Vegas. So a lot of people in town here live by audio. A lot of people live by working in the audio business, mixing engineers with all these live shows. There's a huge community of audio people here, but very difficult to get an AES chapter going because they're working so hard and they're working in the evenings and into the night, and they're not really available to get together after work. My after work is their beginning of the day. So it's a little bit challenging to even Zoe over who runs the studio over at the Palms here in town. We've tried a number of times to get an AES chapter going. So I think that, you know, there's so many people who are interested in this subject need to find a way to get together and bond. We need to find somebody who can put together the common element that can draw those people together. I don't think we found it yet.
How do you see the music business with this changes, all of its changes that keep on continuing? How is that changing your business? I mean, now we're going to a streaming business. So I foresee downloads going away faster than the CD, for instance, and vinyl for sure. But streaming is the name of the game right now, and it's only going to be more so in the future. So how does that affect your business?
Well, I think for high-end, it's actually a good thing, because streaming offers the opportunity for better and better quality than we've seen before. I have a friend, David Chesky, who runs a business in New York called HD Tracks. You know, it was a great example of streaming. Cookie, who owns Blue Coast Records up in the Bay Area, another good example. They're delivering very high quality files across the internet for people to access music at a level they could never have before. You know, I think you've probably talked about on this show the Pono project that Neil Young is working on, which I think is really awesome. I think that there's a good chance that we may see a lot more access to high quality. But I think that there's, in pro audio anyway, there's not always the recognition that the converters and the ability to deliver this information in real time is quite as easy to accomplish as the end user wishes it was. I think the end user is a bit ahead of the industry in their wants, and I think the industry is still trying to catch up to that. I think we could see a lot of manufacturers doing really well in the future, delivering, you know, 24/192 in a pro audio format that you don't really see right now. There aren't that many. I've been working recently talking to Jeff Daking about how do we make a preamp that has a digital output stage, and it's quite difficult. the resources, the parts, the material seem very difficult for a small manufacturer to access. If you're a very large one, you can get access to that those parts, because these companies that make the chipsets, and they want to sell you 10,000. They don't want to sell you 100. So yeah. I think the large manufacturers will probably lead the way with that. And then I think we'll see really smart inventors, people like Dave Hill, you know, who's really good with software, people like that, figure out ways to enable that delivery medium in a way in the studio where we can actually access information right from the studio on the web while it's happening in a very high-resolution format.
Wouldn't that be cool?
Wouldn't it?
Yeah,
that
definitely. It's a good place to stop. Thank you so much for your time, Brad. This has been as fun and as informative as I thought it was going to be.
Yeah, well, thanks, Bobby. It was really nice of you to invite me on.
Thanks very much, Brad.
You bet.
If you want to find out more about Brad and Trans Audio Group and products like ATC, A-Designs, Bach, Drummer, Daking, TubeTech, etc., go to transaudiogroup.com. That's all one word, Trans Audio Group, T-R-A-N-S, audiogroup.com. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@BobbyOInnerCircle, and I really do like to hear your comments and any suggestions that you have either for guests or suggestions about the show in general. Many thanks to Steve Cherubino, who's the host of EDM Producer Podcast at edmmr.com, and he's the guy behind the scenes that makes this show go. Thank you, Steve. To listen to other episodes of Bobby O's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or you can go to bobbyoinnercircle.com, or you can find it on iTunes. Please leave a comment if you're listening on iTunes. At bobbyosinski.com, you can find book excerpts, links to my blogs and coaching programs, as well as a sign-up sheet for my newsletter, and alerts to this podcast as well. This is Bobby Osinski. I'll see you next time.